So it's been a pretty full 2 days, and we're ended by kind of putting it all together. Our thesis for this whole conference is that publishing is a partnership process, and there are any number of different partnerships you will need to engage in, create, maintain, grow, nurture, thrive, throughout your publishing career. And we're very, very fortunate to have a favorite author I know of, me and many of you, Michael Cunningham, and some key members of his publishing team, who at different times work together, at sometimes may be at odds, I don't know, we'll find out, and play different roles at different times. So, Michael, let's just start with you. I'll have you pull that mic over, and then we'll trade around as we go. So, you didn't start off with this, you were not born with this team of people around you.
Oh, I wish.
That's right. It wouldn't be fun to reveal to everyone that they actually already have this team of people.
You know, one of the great things about an intimate relationship with your agent is you can share her Diet Coke without even asking.
This is in fact, the relationship you all want to achieve with your agent. You should have an agent you can share a diet beverage.
Yeah, with. I think so.
Yeah, from the same glass. But let's just give a little history to start off to get us to where you even have an agent. So prior to an agent, had you published anything?
No. I was going to the writer's workshop. I went to the writer's workshop at the University of Iowa, which felt at the time like a sort of pathetic and desperate gesture. I'd gotten my undergraduate degree and sort of gone out of the mad American night to try to wrestle a novel out of it. And a few years later, when I found myself working in a bar in Laguna Beach called the Boom Boom Room, wearing a grass skirt and a lei, I thought, you know, this may not be working out so well. And I applied to some MFA programs. MFA programs were not quite so big.
Well, we're talking now, exactly.
It felt like going to charm school or something kind of awful. But I just didn't know what else. I was just so lost. I just felt so completely alone and crazy in what I was trying to do. I mean, you know, this is Laguna Beach. I didn't know anyone who had ever even read a book. So went to Iowa, a complicated mixed experience, and by far one of its
highlights. Well, let's back up a little bit there, too. How did you even think to go to Iowa? I mean, if you were in a place where people didn't walk with Tolstoy on their head, what would make you want to go to Iowa to learn to do that?
You know, more than anything, I just wanted company.
Yeah. So you didn't really feel like you had
anything. Actually, I still think is one of the better reasons to go to an MFA program. Simply to be part of a community of people who collectively believe that writing a beautiful sentence is a significant thing to do, which is hard to find in the world at large.
That's true.
Yeah.
I always like to say reading is a group activity. Accomplish one person at a time.
Absolutely.
What's amazing about it. So you go to Iowa.
Went to Iowa, and while I was there, Gail came to give a talk about being an agent. She was like 7 years old.
She was nine years old.
No, she was, you know, her parents brought her. They said, this is our little girl. She wants to be an agent one day. I think I just sort of pushily gave you something to read. I don't think you actually asked people to give you things to read, but I did. And she sent me a letter from New York.
Do you remember what you first read at Michael's?
Oh, God, no. I hope not.
But obviously there was something that made you want to represent.
Well, the agents go to
I'm going to ask you to talk to Mike.
The agents who go to these kind of conferences go, you know, with a notebook and an empty satchel. In those days, really, this was a while ago, they would mimeograph the stories. Remember that, like, purple mimeograph stuff?
I know.
And the workshop would not be, well, go online and find the guy's story. The workshop would be, pick up the story by so-and-so person that we're discussing today, and it was that purple mimeographing that some guy would go like this, crank it out. So you go with an empty bag, and you hope to take home some stuff. You go ask the people who run the conference, run the master's program, and the teachers, do you have anybody really great? And you ask the students, do you have anybody really great? And sometimes a couple of names just come up, and, you know, so I may have heard your name that way, or you may have come. I always put a sign up, you know, I'm going to come and speak, and sometimes there's three people in the lounge. That was a long time ago.
Really?
These days,
because I would think you'd have a target.
Yeah.
Don't you? There's like nobody comes. I remember.
Right.
Sometimes a professor would be there just to like pat me on the head. Don't feel so bad. And then you'd have to call the writers that you heard great things about. I remember calling one of them, who was in the bath. He was always in the bath. But they said, you gotta find this guy. It was a different year. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, you read then or later, and I remember we walked by the river. Remember there was a river?
I do.
And we talked about, we went to the quilt show one year.
Right, yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
So it was a town next to an Amish town. So somehow somebody had a car and we drove to a quilt show. We each bought a quilt. And I still have my quilt.
I gave mine away.
You gave yours away.
Plus I don't speak to her anymore. I really want that quilt back. And that's another. Can we talk about quilts?
You know, I have to say, actually, no, but talking about quilts here is important because, you know, we've talked a lot, mostly yesterday, about finding, it's not just finding an agent, it's finding the right agent.
Yeah.
But the fact that the two of you would go to a quilt show.
I think that's the point. I think that we were paisans pretty early on. It was a professional relationship, but it was also very quite immediately a personal relationship.
But you know, that's a question I don't think about much. Every agent in America gets like 30 letters a day. Dear Miss So-and-so, dear Mrs. So-and-so, would you read my manuscript? The same way the editors get like 1,000 manuscripts a day. And that's our life is always reading. You have to remember, we are reading a pile like this no matter who we are. And you're in there. You want us to read every page with heart and soul. Guess what? It's like it's impossible. So you read until something sparks you. Or you meet somebody and you say, God, I hope I like his stuff because I really love the guy. But how do you know it's the right person? What is the right person? There's no answer to it. I get right, there's no answer because there could be... I remember I was an unmarried person years ago, and I said to someone, oh my God, where's my knight in shining armor? I'm the white horse. And the guy looked at me like I was a moron, and he said, honey, there's like 10 guys potentially. And, you know, there could be 10 agents who are good for you. So if you find someone who gets your stuff, who sees what you're trying to do, who's with you, and you don't feel conflict about your material, and you feel that the way they speak about you in the universe is the way you want to be spoken about in the universe, and the clout they wield, if any, or the expertise they have, or the context they have, or the kind of context that will build in well to your career, then you might be in good hands, right?
Yeah. No, I think you can kind of trust your instincts with an agent. You should like your agent.
You should
respect
like
and admire your agent. You should feel like this is one smart mama, and she and we can work together.
But also, the point we're seeing now is that this is a long-term relationship.
Oh my God!
Have you been together longer with Gail than anyone else?
Oh,
well, now that I'm divorced, the answer is yes. Yes, I have been.
I hope that's said in a celebratory fashion. And I should take a moment to admit being a terrible moderator, but I didn't introduce Gail Hockman appropriately. So let me do that right now, who obviously is Michael's agent. But Gail, why don't you just say a little bit about yourself, how long you've been agenting, and maybe a word about AAR.
Oh, okay. So, Gail Hockman, I started publishing out of college, and I had a job at Putnam's, the old Putnam's, privately owned, before it was part of this enormous conglomerate, which now is going to take over, like, what, 3/4 of the publishing world. It was an independent company. I worked there for 2 years, and then I got a job as an agent. I worked for the oldest literary agent at CNRica, which was amazing, founded like 1890-something, you know, very old place. And here I was 23, you know, I feel like I was 9 years old, I was 23 years old. And the guy said, here's your office, you're an agent. So the person before me hadn't read a manuscript in 2 years. So I didn't know what was I going to do. I didn't know how to be him. I just looked around. There was the whole entire office was full of unopened envelopes with manuscript boxes. So I had something to do for a while. So I eventually got some clients. I started to go to some conferences. I went to Iowa and met amazingly interesting people. It was very fertile. I think it was a fertile time. Now everybody goes to an MFA program, right?
Yeah.
And in those days, they were usually not right out of college. They had been in the world somewhere. So they came with... You know, you tell a young writer, the parents of young writers say to me, what should I tell my son? Tell him to have a little worldly experience and then try to write something, right? So I go to Iowa. I started to get some clients. And then after 5 or 6 years at this company, I thought, you know, it's time to move. I'm the company mascot. You know, I was like 9 years old, and I should be a grown-up somewhere. So I went to a company called Brandt & Brandt. And then I had continued with Michael and other people I had started to work with along the way. And I had a couple of major successes. So I said to the guy, please just give me a raise. Give me a $10,000 raise. Please give me a raise. He said, well, let's have a drink. I don't want a drink. I want a raise. So we go to the Century Club, which had recently invited the women to join. And there's a guy with a white towel over his hand. Ceremonially, give me a drink. Just give me a raise. He says, I'm going to make you a partner. That was good. So I got 20, well, whatever percent of the profits. And I say, but how am I going to say this? I don't think we got any profits here. Like, just give me $10,000. But fast forward, I own the office, and the guy is still there who I love, Carl Brandt. It's an office called Brandt & Hockman. I said, doesn't it sound better? I swear I said this. It's not me. Doesn't it sound better, Hockman & Brandt? And he said, well, you know, they'll never find us if we say Hockman & Brandt, because you know, they're going to look up Brandt and something. So, okay, so Brandt and Hoffman. So now I own the office, and in those days, his clients were the important clients, like Wallace Stegner, and we had Sylvia Porter's Money Book, and we had a lot of fabulous kids stuff, and a lot of serious adult fiction, but a lot of nonfiction. And now my stuff runs the office with, you know, things that make money, things that have a lot of prestige. I have a certain number of kids' books as well, which I'm happy about because I always felt that kids should have amazing stuff to read. I was a kid, I read through the kids' library. And kids' stuff stays in print. You know, Michael's stuff stays in print. But many of the authors out there in the world, their book is in print and hardcover, in print and paperback. It will stay in print now with ebooks. But in the olden days, it was out of print in 2 years. And that was a very sad thing. So technological revolution has changed that. But I built up a list of quality fiction and nonfiction, and I'm now nurturing, hopefully, a cadre of younger agents.
So let's go back a little bit. So at the point that you met Michael, you were really building your your first group of writers.
Yeah.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And I know you don't remember exactly what it is you read, but...
Could have been Pearls. There was a story you had in the Atlantic.
There was something
Cleveland.
I had a little.
So you, no, that's a story that you had already had in the Atlantic or that you put in the Atlantic?
I think you had submitted something that was the Atlantic first.
I think that happened through, like, that wasn't.
Okay, so possibly you had an impressive short story publication.
No, that may have been, but the point was, you're there to meet young writers. These people
right.
are very talented. It was very
right.
prestigious to go.
But it really sounds like it really was more about you clicked.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
And you
and whatever
good
I read, I
writer.
Said, oh,
right.
well, you read his stuff, anything he writes. Oh my God, that's a comic. That is a comic. So.
But I have to say, it was a gamble on Gail's part. And I had a couple of early publications. I had the Atlantic and the Paris Review in graduate school, and then nothing. For years and years, and before the evening's over, I promise to tell you terrible things about Gail Hoffman, awful, scandalous things. But for now, I have to tell you that all those years, she returned my calls, she checked up periodically, she never, ever, ever suggested that maybe if nothing had sold in a decade, there was a problem here. And it was just so sustaining. It was so important.
And so at this point that you begin your relationship, you're taking Michael on. At this point, do you have a novel? You're working on a novel? I assume what you first want to sell is a novel. Or is it a short story collection you have?
No, Gail helped me publish what is actually my first novel called Golden States, which I wrote in a panic at about 45 minutes because I was about to turn 30 and I hadn't finished anything really. And it's an okay book. It's not a great book. I'm not even sure if it's a very good book. It's sold. No, please. It's what it is.
Okay.
I wrote it very quickly. It taught me that you're never going to write the book you'd hoped to write, but you can, at the very least, write the very best book you possibly are able to write at that point. And that's why I always felt bad about that book. The others, at least, I gave my all to.
Well, and how nice, I mean, it would be probably less good if you'd written six novels and the first one were the best of them.
Well,
that too. Now, let me ask this, though. So we have this first novel. Who published that first novel?
Crown, actually, a woman named Barbara Grossman, who's no longer in the business. It sold like 17 copies,
right.
mostly to my family, and just didn't make any difference
right.
at all.
So is it fair to say were they not itching to publish the next one, or because
can
obviously
I
no,
yeah,
please,
you're
yeah,
sure.
yeah, yeah,
okay.
yeah.
So we have Golden States, which of course I love this book because I love the characters, and I think Michael's way of presenting his characters are they come alive. They come alive in a way that just I really respond to. Okay, even the novels that were in the closet that you stole back.
Meg stole back.
The material, it just comes alive. Okay, so I have this new novel. We had various drafts and various moments where we were thinking of submitting it. And I had an option with Crown. And we were simplifying the story. So we had an option with Crown, which means when you have your book sold to a publisher, one clause in the long contract, which has thousands of clauses, makes your business arrangement, you know, clear, black and white on paper. It says, your next book you will bring back to this publisher. They're investing in you. They want to see the next book before you send it to anybody else. So at that point, this was not the right publishing house for us, really. They didn't do this kind of quality fiction, but okay. I didn't really want to sell them the next book, nor did you, but fine, we had the option. We sent it to them. Maybe this went through a couple of different drafts we sent to them. And then Michael had White Angel in The New Yorker. Don't you remember that happened next? So White Angel, if any of you have not read it, the minute you get out of here, go Google it. It was like one of the most anthologized pieces of writing that we have in my office, my 100-year-old office. It's an amazing piece. So I'd been submitting this novel, and I get a call from Roger Strauss. And I didn't even understand Roger Strauss would make that first call to anybody. He didn't know me. And he said, Gail. And I said, yes. He said, I'm just mad about this story. Remember, there was like a way of talking. So I said, mad like you're angry? Or like mad like you love it? Mad like I love it, I must have it. So he makes me an offer. And then I call back the option publisher, and I say, look, I have an offer on this book. I'm just telling you, you publish the first book. No, I didn't say that. I said, do you want to publish a second book? I really got to move for this writer. We love this writer. I think he's the real thing. He's important to me. You're sitting on this book. Help me out. Are we interested or are we not? Oh, yes, we are. But we can't deal with it because the boss is in the country. And I said, oh, the boss is in the country. It's very convenient for me. I said, well, the boss is in the country. We can't bother. I said, well, I have to deal with it this weekend. Now, today. So she said, I said, okay, let's play a game. If the boss says to you, do whatever you want for this book, anything, make the offer. You are now the boss. You have the money. You have the checkbook. Tell me what the offer will be. And she says, I said, just think about it. I'm not going to hold you to it. Don't worry about it. Just tell me what it would be. Because you want to buy the book, right? So she says, blah, blah. And I said, okay, now that's your offer. End of story. That's what I'm supposed to take back to the author. And she says, yes, that's my offer. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry to tell you. But I have an offer from Roger Strauss at Ferris Strauss. It's somewhat more money. You'll understand, of course. I mean, she's not going to bother the boss in the country. And Roger Strauss is just mad about this book. Do you see the agent is, it's like, you don't have to be a genius to know where we're going here. So I said, I'm so sorry. I'm so glad you've made an offer, but I respectfully decline, and hung up the phone. And this girl at the time was one of my better friends, and she obviously was looking at that phone like, what the hell just happened? So she let this guy walk out of her life. Too bad. But, and then we ended up, to our great luck.
And this is a perfect time to bring in Jonathan Galassi. Who is beloved in many realms. He himself is a poet, translator, and publisher, editor at Ferris Strauss. And maybe, Jonathan, you can tell us, were you there at this point?
I was. I think there...
I'm going to ask you to speak into the mic.
The person that was left out of the earlier narration was that Dorothea Strauss had read White Angel in New Yorker and pillow talked to Roger, so this is really...
Well, that's why he said, I'm mad about this.
And Dorothea was a very femme Beck in terms of... she was a great connoisseur of writing, and she was the one who first read the piece, and I think that the rest followed from that. And then I think Roger asked me to work with Michael, and that was the beginning of our long and happy relationship. And we've done... We're working on our fifth book together. And that's the way it should be in publishing. It's been a wonderful... developing relationship. Gail and I have had other writers that we've worked very closely with, and it's been it's been a very collaborative relationship. There's always the moment of when you're making the contract, there's always the moment of tension. Is everybody going to be happy and so? But as you can see, we're all still here. So, and I'm sure Gail will have things to say about that. But once we buy the book, then Michael and I have developed a very easy way of relating. I mean, maybe you should talk about that.
Well, let's back up a bit. So now, speaking about now this trio here. So Michael, every writer and agent has a slightly different relationship when it comes to this, but you're about to work on a new book.
Yeah.
How informed is Gail about it, and how frequently along the way is she seeing it?
Sure. Before we move too far along, I just feel like since you're all writers, I just want to tell a quick story that I think people who want to be writers might want to hear. It had been years and years and years, and nothing was selling at all. And I kept sending things to the New Yorker, and I kept getting these notes back. The first few were from anonymous readers, and then if you're lucky, you start getting signed notes. This is from a guy named Daniel Miniker. And I kept sending him stories, and he kept sending them back, saying, try again. And finally, he sent me a note that said something like, he was very discreet, but he essentially said, maybe this just isn't working out. I thought, damn. So, like, you're breaking up with me? Am I going to have sex?
He didn't say that. He said...
No, I said that. I had sent him enough stories that he began to be subtly and frankly a little bit discouraging. And about that time, I started seeing this guy, showed him this novel I was working on, so I thought, well, can we really go out if you think I'm a shitty writer? Yeah, probably, but we should know that. And I showed him the first few chapters, one of which was the chapter that ended up being in the New Yorker, and Kenny said, oh, these are good. Why don't you send them to the New Yorker? And I said, oh, that's so sweet. Here's what you don't understand. The New Yorker actually eventually had to hire somebody named Dan Miniker, whose job it was to wait for a story from Michael Cunningham so that he could send it back and say, we're terribly sorry, maybe you should go. And plus, I said, this is not the kind of story the New Yorker publishes. This story contains children on drugs, sex in a cemetery, violent death, and really, to show Kenny just how difficult my life was, I said, look, I'm putting it in an envelope, I'm going to send it off to Dan Miniker. I'm going to do some errands, it'll be back before I am. However, as it turned out, that was when Mr. Shine, Wally Shawn versus the editor of New Yorker forever, Mr. Shine. First name was Mr. First name was Mr. Had been dismissed, and they had brought in his place Bob Gottlieb, who had been a publisher at Knopf. So, as Dan Miniker quite freely told me, there's no way you could have bought that story when Shawn was the editor, and B, it came out at a time when people were asking themselves, what will the new New Yorker be under Bob Gottlieb? All of which I'm telling you in order to reach the following point. For many of us, certainly for me, you just keep at it and at it and at it and at it until finally somebody cracks the fucking door open. As Marilyn Monroe once said, I wasn't the prettiest, I wasn't the most talented, I just wanted it more than anybody else. Mm-hmm. And it's not bad for us for writers either. Thank you.
So your persistence paid off.
That's really the point, is that for so many of us, it's persistence is crucial. And I remember before I knew better, seeing books by relatively young writers come out. Oh my God! You sat down and wrote this, and now you're a famous writer, right? And you don't know, you don't get the backstory,
right?
You don't get the 5 years, the 10 years, of the whatever, of this increasing conviction that you're another one of the uncountable people who tried hard, had some kind of gift, and didn't get there.
So how long was it then in between this story, I forgot where we are in our timeline now, between this story and the first novel that went to Jonathan?
This was a this was a chapter from that novel.
So it's a chapter from the novel. That's what I thought. Great. And
So Dorothea read it. And
so now we're in the novel. At this point, is the novel finished, or you're working on the novel?
I'm working on the novel, and
it's a mess.
It's a mess. I mean, Jonathan probably may or may not feel reluctant to say this, but I certainly don't. It was all over the place, and it really needed serious help.
So I guess what I'd like to hear is, before it even went to Jonathan, how were you two involved, if at all, in writing, rewriting, revising what you had first written before it even went to Jonathan? Then we'll hear from Jonathan about how you two worked together.
Okay, well, my attitude in general is, if I want a distinguished editor at a really good house to read my guy's stuff, and I read the stuff and something there is unclear, or it doesn't hit home, or it's repetitive, or, you know, whatever the big or small things are, why would I send it to him and have him read what I know the guy can do better? So the agent has the luckiest job in the world. The agent of a good writer gets to read the stuff first, usually. That's pretty good. I mean, that's pretty exciting. So when you're reading for a really good writer, you don't want to say, hey, you know, you got to do this, you got to do that, do this, I know I'm right. You don't know you're right. You just know, as a reader, this is how I'm feeling. If it helps you, I didn't understand this and I didn't understand that, and I felt this was a little slow. But if that's the way you want it to be, no problem. It's fine. I just like to say something so he would hear what I think. Sometimes you say to me, I'm very nervous about this. What do you think? And I just want the book to speak to the reader. I want the book to arise on its own terms, do its own thing in its own way. There's no right or wrong. I want it to do whatever the author's trying to make it do. And I want to help give enough feedback to help him get where he's going. Not where I want him. I don't have anywhere I want him to go. What's where he's going? Now, sometimes we all work on books that we know are exactly the kind of thing that we only get rejected. It always gets rejected. But if I'm working with a writer and I like this book, that's my job, to help the guy get his book where it's going to be. And I don't say, you have to do it for me, because I'm only one reader. I say, this is my perception. Do what you think makes sense.
Now, let me ask you. So you send the book to Jonathan, and he says, I'm interested, presumably, at this point.
Well,
but if you can remember back to this book, because, you know, now you've done a bunch, but did the two of you, because he doesn't yet know Michael, I don't think, did the two of you have a conversation before Michael's brought in about what might be done with the book? Or, Jonathan, you just take it on, and then it's between you and Michael? What happens at that point with this particular first book that you were on?
Well, I don't remember exactly. If Roger called and said you love this piece, then you must have shown us the manuscript.
I would have sent you the manuscript, and okay. He would have given it to.
And I don't remember what state it was in.
I don't remember it being so bad either. Do you?
I don't remember. I don't. I don't think of the work that you and I have done over the years as being. I think of it as being more fine-tuning than structural organization or big cutting, or it's more shaping and pointing up this, taking this out, and so, but what I would call tailoring, not.
I meant a mess, and which is slightly different from actually bad. It was, you know what I mean. It was all over the place. It had all kinds of good parts, but they didn't necessarily seem like they were part of the same book.
You haven't seen what I've seen.
Oh, I agree that part of a big part of our relationship has always been honing it in, talking about where to expand, where to contract, stuff.
I think that some editors are more prescriptive than others. I don't tend to be. I think Gail and I are pretty. It's the author's book, and our job, first hers and then mine, is to help the author reach the closest, as close as he can come to the platonic ideal of that book, which sometimes an editor or an agent can help the author identify in a way that he could. Because we're not so close in, but it's really the author's book, and the editor is really just a sounding board and a, you know, suggester. But the ideal editor, the ideal response to an editor's suggestion, is something that the editor can't think of, that the author brings to the manuscript.
And let me ask, and this can be through any of the novels and ongoing. In general, when
you've had this meeting about, okay, I've read through the manuscript, here are my suggestions, or here's my read of it, and some things you might want to do. Are you then meeting regularly over some period of time, or do you go off for a number of months and then come back with something else? How does that relationship work?
Well, for me, it just takes as long as it takes, and I know we all know that I work steadily and hard, and sometimes it just takes a long time. So there is no particular. You know, people ask me, so is your editor upset because your manuscript is a year late? Does your editor make you make certain changes? And I have lived a constant professional life. It's sort of like being asked, well, so like how long did your parents lock you in the closet when you were bad? No, that possibility never even occurs to me.
I mean, I think the idea that an editor is here is like Simon Legree, who's there, you know, trying to extract labor from you, is really not what goes on in this kind of relationship. It's really, I'm there to receive what you produce and then respond to it, and then it goes back to you, basically, for ultimate, and that might happen a couple of times, but no, as time goes on, first of all, writers learn how to write. I've always say about biographies, but it's true of other books, that you learn to write the book by writing the book, and by the time at the end, you go back and fix what you need to fix. And often, I think that with an experienced writer, that happens before I even see it. Mm-hmm. You know, but so I think that I actually think the most important thing that an editor provides is support, encouragement, belief, partnership. You know, especially as time goes by, you know. Hopefully, the writer feels that the editor understands what he's doing.
And now that Mike, let me ask you. Now that you're fortunate to have this genuine kind of permanent home. I mean, you know that your next book will probably be with Jonathan and certainly with Gail. When you're about to embark on a new novel project or any writing project, nonfiction, are you using either or both of them as sounding boards? Is this a fully private affair and you announce to them what is happening next? At what point do they know what you're working on next?
Yeah, as I recall, it seems to vary from book to book. I think the last couple of books we've worked more closely. I've shown you more unfinished things, but I don't know why that is exactly. Your relationships change, your needs change.
We also sold the last couple of books on less material in the first place.
Oh, yeah, because we needed the money, yeah, right.
I think that the first
we had a big
chunk
of the baby needed
that
operation.
We had a huge amount of material.
About that part, yeah.
I'm not talking about it, I'm just talking about
it. I can say this, that early on, actually before I met Jonathan or Jeff, or maybe even before I met you, Gail, I like so many young aspiring writers, I was writing into the ether. I was writing to the extraterrestrials. I was writing for generations to come, and that concept got a little slippery on me, and I began to think of anything I was writing as something, I'll say a gift, because a book is a gift. It's meant as a gift, right? You're saying, I want to give this job, I want to give you what I hope will be a fascinating and moving experience for you. And I thought, I'm writing this next story for Sarah and Jamie and Francis, and that's still true. And it's not so much a question of how it's Jonathan and Gail and Ken. There's seven or eight names. It's not so much anticipating their reaction it's not so much anticipating their approval or disapproval as it is, oh, I bet Jonathan liked this part. You know, it really helps and has helped for years for me to think of any book as meant specifically for a small body of people who I know and love and respect. And if other people want to read it too, that's fine.
Yeah. Well, I love this idea that you're really writing for readers that you have in your head.
I really recommend it. to any, it made a big difference to me.
Ultimately, though, of course, you want to be read by people you don't know. And that's where maybe we bring in Jeff Soroy. How's that for a segue? Jeff, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you do and at what point, how long you have been involved with the rest of the trio here, and how that ongoing relationship works.
Well, I came to FSG in 1995. In fact, my first day of work was March 27th, which was the publication day of Flesh and Blood. So on my first day of work, I went off to the party in Paul Morris's gallery. Hostesses were drag queens from so it's been
that was your
since
first
then.
Day of blood. That was a pretty good party, wasn't it?
That was a great party.
Job. Yeah, I think it was really
and
all
I
about
kept on
the drag,
at the
drag
end of
queens.
It, I was tugging Michael because we had a dinner reservation for him. All the drag queens wanted their books autographed, and it was very hard to get out of there. So I've been working with these guys since, I guess, day one at FSG, which was about 17 years ago. And at that time, I was the publicity director. Now I really kind of organize and administer the publishing side, which is all of the activities where the book goes out the door. In other words, advertising, publicity, digital promotion, sales promotion. It's the kind of thing where we're trying to figure out put together publishing plans and figure out what to do for all of the different books and then execute them and then troubleshoot and try to get all of the different elements in all the different ways to reach readers and potential readers to coordinate into some kind of effective plan.
And Jeff, because I think a lot of the writers here may not know that there's a distinction between these two things, being pre-publication and post-publication. So if you could maybe talk a little bit about what you do for a book before it comes out, as opposed to, you know, at the point that it's coming out.
The first thing that we do is, and it's very easy for me to say this because we had a launch meeting earlier this week, so the first thing that we do is most publishing houses have three seasons a year, winter, spring, and fall, and there's a launch meeting, and at the launch meeting, all the editors tell us about the books that they have on the list, and so that's really about a year out. Earlier this week, we had a meeting that concerned all the books we'll publish between September and December, a year from now, and that's our first introduction to those books. And then, in the next few weeks, if the manuscript is ready, we try to read it. If there's only part of it ready, we try to read it, familiarize ourselves with the work. We always have, at FSG, we always have the authors in. Sometimes they come with agents and sometimes they come on their own, and we sit down with them and we try to make them but our view is that they are the, well, we might try to make some of them, but our view is that they're the primary stakeholder and it's really, really helpful for us to hear the writer talk about the book in his or her own words, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. Part of what we do has to do with getting books noticed by the critical establishment, and that's entirely based on what's between the two covers of the book, the actual work itself, and that's the critical world. But then a lot of what we do has to do with media and other kinds of coverage, and so we have to tell stories about the book and stories about the author and how the book came into being and who the author is and what's interesting in there. So we kind of ask the writers to tell us stories about themselves, about the book, so we can start to formulate the way that we're going to talk about the book. And some writers, like Michael, are very keen to get away from their desk and their writing space and get out into the world and meet their readers and kind of have a change in the way they're living for a while and be very public. And some are very shy, and so we kind of try to honor that. Our job isn't to push them into doing things. Our job is to say, look, we're going to bring you opportunities. We think you can do this. We think this will be really helpful for your book. We think we know so-and-so's super excited to interview or super excited to like sponsor you in doing something.
And are you the one procuring the drag queens for the launch events, or is that Michael?
Well, I was pre that event, but I think actually Michael was involved.
I did procure those drag queens.
I don't know why.
I'll do it for anybody, really.
Does that kind of explain
it? No, I think that's really helpful for people to know. Let me ask that. So at the point that you've developed your publicity plan for the book, with Michael's involvement, are the rest of the team we have here involved still, or is their part done and you're running with it?
Their part is very much done. Their part is not very much done. They're very much involved. Gail is very is I don't know. We have a good relationship and we talk on the phone all the time. And Gail's a great communicator, as you can see. It's very easy to talk to her, to work with her. And some agents are absentee, and some agents are very present, and some agents are, okay, we have a problem, let's try to figure out how to sort through it and make it work, and some don't make life easier. In this instance, we're really all very shoulder to shoulder in what we do. Well, we basically take our cues from Michael. I mean, I think the first book that we worked on together was The Hours, and what I recall of that was that the manuscript was turned in and circulated in house, and excuse me, everyone who read it was kind of walking around kind of saying to each other in hushed tones, God, this book is really a marvel. Everything about it is absolutely perfect. It's beautiful, it's incredibly broad, there's not a comma that's in the wrong place. And it was just, no one knew whether it was going to be big or small. No one knew whether it was going to win a Pulitzer Prize or not. No one knew anything except that it was an amazing creation. And then Michael came in, and what I remember him saying was, I don't know what we're going to do with this book. It's really small. It's experimental. I don't know who the readers are. It's not for the people who read my last books. It's, I was just trying to do something. We'll see what happens. And we were all like, is that the book I just read? No.
Actually, Jeff, I've always wanted to ask you this question. What a perfect opportunity. It does seem to me that in the realm of books in particular, who knows what's going to hit and what's going to miss. And, there was a great effort made on behalf of Flesh and Blood, which I think some people thought was going to be my sort of great, my big family saga that was going to fly off the shelves, and that just didn't happen. And maybe people read The Hours and thought, I see $100 million movie in the future of this book, but that would surprise me a little.
Yeah, usually referencing Virginia Woolf means a hit movie.
Virginia Woolf. Why didn't I think of that earlier?
Actually, I think
Goldmine. Yeah, but you know what I mean. It just seems so. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean.
I think the first thing that happened with The Hours that made it all start to grind was the Penn Faulkner Award, mm-hmm. wasn't that? He won that in January or something.
No, Penn Faulkner was like May.
No.
It's January. Okay.
It was before the
Award.
Right.
And I don't think often you don't know what's gonna, we loved the book, but we didn't know that it was gonna be box office like that.
Yeah.
Well, when I read the book, I remember sitting in my house and I finished it and then I started again and I read it again. And I called Michael, we didn't have email then, I guess. I said, all I could say was, Oh, because this was, you're not going to say, I really like the characters, and I just could not get, and I remember thinking, okay, they're going to make a beautiful object of it, not just that it's a beautiful book, and this is something, I'm going to go to dinner parties, I remember saying this to somebody, and bring this instead of a bottle of wine. I thought this book was an eternal book, and how often in any of our careers do we have a book we feel that way about? That was pretty amazing. And then we had no idea what the business would be, and Jonathan said, okay, we don't want to sell it out for paperback, we're going to do it a different way. And I remember saying, but we're losing a little bit of money because of the way the money thing used to work. And we worked out a very creative deal, which ended up benefiting both of us, like, hugely, like, hugely. But this was this miracle book, and it sold. And then Hollywood People, this was unbelievable. Hollywood People, now, do you know anybody here know anything about Hollywood People? It's like, do they even read? I mean, they read everything. They know, say, they cover everything for the movies, but... we don't think of them as like intellectuals, like the Ferris Strauss team appears to be intellectuals and smart. And one by one, these Hollywood people came into my office and they said, that's my favorite book. And I kept a straight face. Because, I mean, this book was such a marvel. It was so amazing. I have to just go back for 1 second to go off the hours, but just go back to the idea of the agent and the team in the publishing house. Many writers out there, they want the agent to be their best friend. And everything you write, I'm supposed to tell you how great you are. Okay, well, that's interesting. You lose because you don't want to hear how great it is. You want me to help you make it the best it can be. So that's one. Number two, I go to the editor. They want me to send it to the editors. They want the editors to think I'm such a great agent, so they'll read it fast and thoroughly. Fine. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it doesn't. They want me to be a bully, fight with the editor and fight with the company and push for more money. And they think that I'm on the other side of a desk, and the desk is really like, you know, the opposite sides of a war field. And frankly, the best results I have ever had and my best relationships are with editors with whom the only time we're on the opposite side of the desk is when we're discussing money or some contract thing. Or I might beg them to do something for the author that they're not sure benefits the author. But we don't view it ever as a battlefield, because both of us, I think, want to leave. And I know that I'm very pushy. I know it doesn't look like I would ever be pushy, but I'm very pushy. And I say, Jonathan, I know you don't want to do this. Think about this, but I really think we want to do this. Please, please think about it. Don't even answer me. We'll talk later. We always reach a compromise. We always feel like we've been a little pushed or a little stressed. We always walk away. And I always say, I hope, I just want to make sure you're happy. This is what I really wanted to happen. I want you to be happy. I want me to be happy. And there's not even 5 minutes of a battle. There is no battlefield. And the only way this whole teamwork works is when I have something unpleasant to call somebody about, I have to find a way that's not nasty. I have to say, I'm doing this because I'm thinking this. I could be right. I could be wrong. Help me out. But it's a team, and there's no question about it. So all of you who want your agents to be aggressive and nasty and pushy, that's fine. You're losing out on the potential that's the best push for your book, which is a team.
Collaborative, right. I just want to remind everyone of what the producer of the film said about it. Do you remember that?
What?
About the hours?
I think I did.
Three depressed lesbians. You do the math.
I know. We looked at the tagline. Three depressed lesbians. You do the math. Which didn't speak to have $100 million profit anyway.
You know, to answer your question, Michael. I mean, yeah, I've been in publishing for. We've all been in publishing for a long time, and I can honestly say that I've never seen a really good book not ultimately reach its audience and get the credit it deserves. The ones that escape the puddle of gravity, like The Hours, you know, you never know that that's going to happen.
Yeah.
You wish that that's going to happen, and you wish that that's going to happen for a lot of books. And when it happens, it's phenomenal. It's incredibly gratifying. But wouldn't you say that it's very, very rare that a truly good book, truly worthwhile book gets no recognition in the course of his lifetime? I can't really say I've seen that.
I'd say there are a lot of good books that don't get as much recognition as they deserve. What I do think is, I don't think that it's that there are a lot of good books that don't get published.
I do.
That don't get published at all? Mm-hmm. Well,
I mean, now you can self-publish it. And you can go to small houses out there, but...
But we can disagree on what constitutes publishability, et cetera,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Et cetera. But
what constitutes recognition?
I do think that for, as you say, to achieve liftoff, to become iconic, that's something that only happens very occasionally, and there are a lot of good books that might have had that happen and didn't, and you know, there's an element of luck in huge success, but I think that no one who reads The Hours feels that it didn't deserve all the success it got. It's an incredible book. And then
I've heard from a few people who one does here, but then no.
But it's part of the continuum of Michael's work. And, you know, and in a way, we're not dealing... See, that's one of the things that I think is true when you have a collaboration that we've been lucky to have, is we're not... You know, Roger used to say this, and I think that it's very true for us in the ideal circumstance, that we're not publishing the books, we're publishing the author. So that the hours is, you know, I was wrong. This is our sixth book, not our, our fifth book. But, you know, it's part of the continuum of Michael's work that we're involved with, and it has, you know, has assigned, you know, has different vicissitudes and ups and downs and lows and highs, and just like any life does. But the life of Michael Cunningham's writing is something that we're involved with for the long haul. All of us, all four of us.
Yeah.
So.
And I mean, I think that this is where the whole team thing becomes so important. That once, if you're lucky enough to get published at all, and then if you somehow like win the lottery and your book really gets out there. You go back to LA, where you grew up, and your parents are having a party for you, for their friends, after you've just won this prize, and their closest friend, who has a son about your age, who hasn't yet won a Pulitzer Prize, comes drunkenly after you. I just saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal, which was the most vicious slam imaginable. Which was an act of public humiliation, essentially saying that that Tom Wolfe, who did not win the Pulitzer that year, was a real writer and a real man, and I was just some weepy sissy who should fuck off and die. I mean, it gets that bad. And then your parents' friend, whose son is selling carpet tiles, is like, I read it. and you know. Your team really helps.
Yep. Well,
which is why you want to.
And
have a
but
team.
Then they're the ones who read that review and said, "Hey, great review in the Wall Street Journal."
But, you know, okay. There's only two ways to react when a friend gets a bad review. Don't mention it at all, or congratulate them on having and pissed off another idiot.
Let's back up a little bit, because if you can remember, Jeff, when the you know, Mike was not yet a household name at the point that the hours that you've read it, and it's not yet out there, hasn't won any awards, just about to be published. You're crafting the publicity campaign with the rest of the gang here. You didn't put out there that it's three depressed lesbians. You do the math. What was, at that point, I suspect it may have changed throughout the course of the book's life, even through now, but maybe it hasn't. But what was what you focused on, publicity-wise, back then, if you can recall? How did you think you were going to sell this book? That is somewhat experimental and a little odd and has historical things and literary references.
In that particular case, I don't think there was much of a strategy beyond telling people that we loved it and how much we loved it and that they had to read it and that they were doing themselves a terrible disservice if they didn't. And so it was just conveying genuine passion and enthusiasm and love for the work in that case. And I don't think we didn't have to come up with an angle or a spin or anything like that. He's a literary writer, and this was a great piece of literature, and we just kind of kept it very streamlined, you know?
I think one thing that we worked on, and Michael was very involved in, was the jacket for that book, which was a series of photographs of a pair.
Yeah.
But there was a sense of repetition and time passing.
There were 12 of them.
And I think that image was very indicative of certain elements in the structural elements in the book. Mm-hmm. But I think what Jeff is saying is something that is really true for literary works is, you know, it's like, you know, they talk about marketing plans and stuff. You know, we're not selling the high concept of this book is that it's a great piece of it's a great novel, you know, and so I think that there isn't really a magic formula for that. I think it's part of what I'd say about that is that a place like FSG sort of exists to publish this kind of thing, and it falls squarely within the, right in the center of what we do, and so when we put it forward, you know, we're sort of standing behind it as something that we love and are proud of, and I think that that's probably our strongest marketing tool that we have for it.
Well, yeah, there's also a kind of feedback process too, because we start talking about the book and then we send out galleys and then we have people read them and they talk to us. So you start working with feedback pretty early in the process from the bookseller community and from the critical community and from literary institutions that we work with, and you know, opportunities come up which we might have hoped for or we might not even have imagined. But you just kind of put the word out in a lot of directions, then you see what kind of feedback you get, and then you work with that to develop. So it really is very much a process. And to me, I agree with what Jonathan said about marketing plans. You know, I mean, the plan is that you're going to do everything, you know, and then you start doing everything, and the plan in some ways gets more and more focused as you move forward, because you know where the thing that you have, as you move towards publication, you get a stronger and stronger sense of where a book is going to play and how it's going to play and who's going to support it. And so you try to maximize that and kind of leverage the opportunities you have. You know, we have a very good reputation. People like hearing from us because they like the stuff that we bring them. And so it's not, you know, we don't have to hold people's heads underwater to convince them that we're bringing them something that's worth their attention. And that's the great advantage of FSG, really, is the what the brand stands for.
So remember, every agent supposedly loves every book that we send out. And some we love more than Dunkerman. But sometimes it's a special book. No, and Ferristrass is a special house. They do not do the run-of-the-mill. Publishing has become a big business, which is one of the sad things for all of us. Business, business, business. Gail, I have to reject your book because I won't sell copies. Sometimes we love that book. And Ferristrass will also reject a book, but when they feel they don't love it or they don't know how to try to sell it, they're not going to say, I can't sell X number of copies. It just doesn't, you don't hear from them. They may think it, I don't hear it. So all of us love our books. Jonathan loves his book. So let's say we don't know how to pitch this or this book. What are we going to say to the world every time? It's so special, just trust me. You can't do that. You have to save it for the book that is so amazing. And then over time, like you have seen from Ferristrass, their word is correct. This is an amazing book. And you have done this, not a whole lot of times, but when you do. So now, I remember 100,000 years ago, I was 12 years old as an agent, and a book came out called The White Hotel. It had a Daily Times review. The review came out, and it started something like this. I have no idea how to describe this book. It's the most extraordinary thing I've ever read. You just have to read it. Does that ring a bell? Something like that. So we all ran to get this book, which was quite an extraordinary book. And at the time, it broke the rules or whatever it was. So that's what he's saying. That's the energy that's generated. But each of you might write a unique book, and it's so wonderful. And people call me and say, well, Gail, I know you'd say you can't sell it, but I'm not talking about selling copies to you. I'm talking about selling, the agent sells to the publisher, Ferristrass or Random House or whatever we sell to. But look at this book. Look at that book. It got 100 turndowns. Keep sending it. How am I going to say to the author, this book isn't magical? So I usually say, if I ever say to any of you, this is not transcendent. That's what I mean. I mean, all of us would leap over rushing waters for the books that we feel are transcendent, and we have, and we do it every day. Even when it's pushing the ball uphill, it's what we do.
And Jonathan was talking before about the packaging and how effective that was on the hours, and I just want to point out that that too is something that's very much a team process. Michael, I know you were very involved with that. I remember at one point you said the type needed to look like Gucci, like a Gucci bag. And so we ran uptown to get Gucci shopping bags. The art department was right across the hall from the publicity department, so I know they were up there getting all those bags so they could see what the type was and the colors and so forth. And it actually, I mean, if you look at the jacket for the original jacket for the hours in that light, you can see that it looked like the bags at that time.
It's very Gucci. Yeah.
I
remember that. I was walking around and I saw somebody carrying a Gucci bag, and I just thought, yeah, right. Not because it was so elegant and confident and not flashy. The color of the type that he, Gucci, was almost the same color as the bag. It was that whole like. We're not flashy.
Palette,
we don't have to be.
The palette was kind of from that brown and silver.
Yeah.
The doctor says the type was different.
And I just thought
there was
type
a kind
that's
of,
different.
There's a streamlined look to it.
Yeah.
Was,
yeah. Same problem. Yeah. Good
job. It's just so much fun hearing people really working together. It's always exciting. I think, you know, we always hear about, I think writers often think that publishers are these sort of mysterious fortresses, barriers that have to get past. And it's, you know, to see that, in fact, it really is a whole lot of people who love books. And that doesn't mean every single book, as you say, everyone can be passionate about. But if you write a book that some people are passionate about, it will make its way to people who come. If it makes its way to people who love it, other people will love it, too. That's basically how it works. I think we have time for some questions. Yeah.
Okay, so it's 2012. You're 30-something. You're starting out now. What would you do different, considering the world of publishing now, how everything's changed? As an agent, as a writer, as an editor, as a publicity person, what would you do? It's hard times.
Well, I think all of us would say that we're all looking for the same stuff. We're looking to discover a new voice. We're looking for something fresh. We're looking for something original. We're looking for something. We sit there reading it at home, and we want to stay up an extra hour to read a couple more chapters. We're on the train. We miss our stuff. It's all the same. We want to feel engaged. We want to feel like, oh my God, I better get to the office and call the agent. I love this book. I don't want it to get away. You know, it's the same old, same old. So as a writer, you should realize that all of us get 600 million billion submissions. When I started out, remember, it was like one submission, and then you waited for them to reject it, and then you sent to the next guy when we started out, right? Different. Everybody sends things out. The writer says, oh, you're only sending it to 12 places? And I'm thinking, let me just keep my shirt on. I'm not going to scream. You're only sending it to 12 places. So that means a billion. Every editor now has 12 times as many things as they used to have because
it's like
all this
college
stuff.
Applications.
It's like yeah. So you should realize that you have to stand up for your own book. You have to listen to the comments. Don't change it because Jonathan says it's dark, too dark, or I say it's not funny enough. Change it because you hear what we're saying. You're trying to accomplish blah 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 with your book. We are not getting it. Listen to our comments in that way. Maybe you're trying to do something that is so overwhelmingly boring. None of us have any interest. Maybe listen to that. You know, you are now one of 500 million billion people trying to sell their book, and every agent is sending their books out to 12 people at once. So these guys, I mean, I went to dinner with an editor once. My bag is like overflowing with papers flying out, and she had a little Kindle all very neat in her beautiful bag. And she had a list, and I reopened it up, and she had a list of 12 things, the book title, the author, and the agent. And I'm looking at it, I said, is that what you're doing this week? She had this little bag, and I have this, is that what you're doing this weekend? She says, yeah. And then I realized, she starts reading. Now, Ferris Stress may be different. Every editor is different. She reads whatever she wants to read first or has to read first. She reads. How long do you think she reads? Just anybody take a guess. How long is she going to read it? 300-page book.
1 page, 2 pages?
No, she reads it as long as she's engaged. It's just that simple, right? And if it's a paragraph, it's a paragraph. If it's a page or a chapter or 500 pages, and then you say to the author, look, there's no action in your book. I have writers who have no verbs. There's like no verbs. Ever. Nobody ever sweats. Nobody ever walks across the street. Nothing ever happened. So I called a guy. One time he wrote a thriller. And I said, honey, it's really hard where all of the action is off stage. And there's one verb every chapter. We've got to work on it. But now I forgot even why I told you that. But I mean, I know there's two verbs in your book. But we read until we feel. I remember years ago, I read this very weird manuscript. My husband says, what is that thing you're reading? And I said, well, it's a story about an IRA, a girl trying to get into the IRA, the Irish Republic. She had to prove her commitments, and she had to get gonorrhea and give it to, I don't know what, it was like so disgusting. He said, get that thing off the bed. He said, get that thing. He said, are you going to help the writer? No. Is the writer going to help you? No. Are you going to make any money for the writer? No. Is that writer going to make any money for you? No. Well, get it off the bed. It's disgusting. Do you understand? The book has to, you have to be able to give it to somebody, and that person says, oh, my God, this is really something. Whatever kind of book it is. If it's a romance, a mystery, for that kind of reader, it has to do that.
I mean, the business is changing a lot. It's true, but I think but what's changing are the formats and the means of delivery and opportunities for reaching people, but the basic things are just the same. I mean, we have a lot of young people at FSG, including young editors who are acquiring books by young writers, and we have young publicists who kind of get who the audience is and how to connect it with it. And it's you know, it's really kind of plus a charge in a way. I mean, you know, I don't understand. I don't understand some of the stuff they're talking about or doing, but it doesn't matter whether I understand it or not. It's just, it's comparable to the kind of thing I was doing 10 years ago or 15 years ago in terms of it's getting the word out and getting things going. And it's basically, I think the process is very much the same, isn't it, really?
We all want to fall in love. It's that simple. We want to fall in love.
Jonathan has a thought that's staying.
No, I think the basic interchange between the publisher and the author is exactly the same. But I think the method of selling the book is different. There are differences. I actually think there's much more pressure on the selling of a first book than there used to be. And I think that's a problem. I think that there's a lot of sudden death in the public. You know, like, okay, Michael's first book is a book that he doesn't really feel is he feels his work, real work, began later. I think he'd say. But he published that book, and he went through the experience of working with an editor, learning about the whole process of writing, relating to the audience, relating, you know, and that's a kind of salutary thing, and there was a lot more of that in the old days than there is now, and I think that's too bad that we don't have that.
That change happened not last year. That change happened.
No,
quite a
it
while
happened
ago.
In the, over the last 20, 25 years.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
I'm just saying things are different, and I think there's more pressure on the writers to produce something perfect, and that's there's more pressure on the publishers to invest in these things. I think it's much more pressurized system. I don't know if you agree with that, Gail. But
well, I'm a dreamer, and so I sit there and I read like 20 manuscripts every weekend, which is insane. And sometimes I just fall in love, and I can fall in love with a book that's very flawed, but something about it's so amazing. I mean, I had a deal recently which was so amazing. A lot of people read this book, and I had an editor who's a good friend call me on like a Sunday. I was about to step in the shower and the phone rang. I'm like naked, I'm talking on the phone. She says, I'm obsessed with this book. That was amazing. The book was very flawed, but it was a weird and haunting subject. And I think I sent it to Courtney. I mean, people liked it, but they didn't feel obsessed. So I got lucky. She made the writer totally revamp it. She gave me a very low offer. The author called me and said, I am crazed or something. I said, oh, thinking, what do you mean? And not crazed in a good way. And I'm thinking, oh, how nice. I sent it out on Thursday. She calls me on Sunday. And you're not happy. How interesting. Well, let's see what other people think. And somehow I had time. And they came one after the other. People liked it. They didn't love it. Do you know me? I had put the pieces together. We're building. I can't remember what this question was, but we build everything. And all of us put our two cents into the editorial, into the passion. She loved this book. I remember thinking, I am luckiest agent alive today. I don't care how much money you pay me. You're obsessed with this book? That's good for me. She said, I think we can make this book, because it was about a historical figure who's not very well known. And, you know, there have been amazing books recently about historical figures who are well known, but put into novels. And we all are interested in the time and the place and that person, and that's kind of an interesting kind of novel. And this was a very unknown person. I felt I was the luckiest agent alive. I didn't care how much the money was. This was the right thing for this author.
But the author didn't think so first.
Well, then I sat there with my pile of work, and I wrote her. I was so furious. I didn't want to call, because if I called, I would have started to scream. So I wrote a really good email. I said, let me tell you the way the business is. And I just had to, you know, I had to go down the whole thing. It's very hard to sell a book. I'm selling it to a major house, a commercial house, and it's a literary novel. The editor was dying to roll up her sleeves and work with her. Okay, so then I figure, oh, God, this writer happened to be very difficult to deal with. So I'm thinking, oh, God, my editor is a good friend. She's going to kill me. She never talked to me. I'll never have lunch with this one again, ever. So they have their conversations, and we get over that hump. She says, okay, we'll take the offer. I didn't tell her what the first offer was, which was even less than the offer that she was screaming about. So she does a revision, and I thought we'd go through five revisions. I get an email from the editor, and she says, I am blown away. One revision. Isn't that amazing? I'm blown away. In other words, what she had hoped this book would be it got there. Isn't that's a great story. You know, so. And then there are other people we all have worked with who have had millions of rejections. People don't get it at all. Sometimes I read the rejections when I'm getting them from publisher after publisher, and I say, you know what, I'm not going to sell this book. And sometimes I sit back and I say, let me read this book again. I start again to read it. And I have gotten energy again by thinking, these guys are wrong. I mean, I have a client named Ursula Hegge, and her big book is called Stones from the River. Before Stones from the River, there was a little book that was beautiful, and I got a lot of rejections on it. And I said, you know what, I'm not crazy. I'm a smart girl, I'm not an idiot. I start reading again, and it just gave me that energy back. Isn't that interesting? And then Stones from the River was her next book, which was a huge breakout book. That was pretty amazing.
Jonathan Galassi, you were just talking about how you're with the writer for the entire career and the ups and the downs. That sounds like things I read about Richard Yates and John Cheever back in the middle of the 20th century. And it almost makes me want to weep to hear that, because you're the only person who's saying that now.
That's right.
Why are you able to do that and nobody else is?
Well, it's not just me, it's all of us together.
I don't mean you individually, I mean FSG.
Oh, no, I think it's something where Gail, Michael, Jeff, and I, it's something that we're all committed to, really. I think it all starts from Michael believing that that's the best thing for
right.
this work, you know. So it's not what I do or what FSG do. It's, I always say, and I'm sure, pardon me for saying it again, but the only people it makes sense for us to publish are people who want to be published by us, who want our approach, who for whom that kind of publishing makes sense for their work. And, you know, it's not always the most money, but I think we have a pretty good record of long-term retention with authors, and because it has to be because they feel that we have done well by them. That, you know, if Michael, you know, Michael and I are really close friends. Over the years, we've become very fond of each other. But if he thought that we weren't publishing his work well, he would have to do something about that.
Well,
so I think that it's about a mutual buy-in, really. Mm-hmm. It's that we, I mean, do you
but
guys,
you know, you're right. FSG is really unusual in this way. And as a special surprise feature, after we're done, they're bringing in the evil publishing panel. you could have four people up here with the same relationship and get a very different story about the business aspect, about the writers. Dissatisfaction, no matter what he's been offered, etc., etc., etc. This is not exactly
also
the norm.
This is, you know, not all our relationships are like this. You know, not first of all, we lose authors on price all the time. Not all authors have managed to write the great books that Michael has written and is writing. You know, so that, but what I'm saying is that over time, there's a significant track record with, you know, over. So, I mean, so it's a process that's, but it involves a mutual commitment, I think.
But also remember, the agent doesn't work for the publisher. So I have very bratty clients, and they say, well, I think I want to go to another house. And I'm thinking, you are so lucky that Counterpoint did such a great job with your book. What are you saying? And I'm mortified, but I don't work for Counterpoint, and I don't work for Fair Stuff. So this is in politics. They don't have to listen. But often I will call a client, and I will say, look, I'm glad we have the next book. I just want to remind you, all the editors that take me to lunch want to buy you. I'm not saying you should leave, and most of the time I really do not want them to leave, but I work for him. So I might say, Michael, I just want to remind you, I could stand on the steps of the public library and I could just put up a sign and I would have people giving me money. So you need to make sure that you're committed to what we're going to do with Ferris Strauss. Not to be cautionary, but that is my job. And I'm not doing my job if I don't remind him that he is, you know, it's not just, oh, we all love each other. It's a business for him. And it's, And I'm sitting there, of course, praying that if I think it's a good relationship, and I know these guys have their heart and soul, and everything is on the line. This book is as important to them as it is to him. Basically, that's how I feel for the stuff that I've sold you. And I have never not felt that. But you understand, the agent works for the writer, and for half the writers in the world want more money, and they want more this, and they want more that, and they complain about everything. But my job is to work for them, but make sure that I help them get to smarter decisions rather than stupid decisions.
But that's what I mean about the mutual buy-in. You guys have to decide that it's what is right for Michael's career. So, and we have to decide that it's something that works for our enterprise, because we're a business too. You know, it's not just about loving the authors. We need to be profitable so that we can publish more books and take home our own paychecks. You know, so it only works when it works.
Right. I mean, mind you, if Michael had previously had 5 books that were edited by Jonathan that all sold significantly less than the print runs and were then pulped, we wouldn't be having this panel with these folks right now.
No, I mean, not most writers don't have the don't get to where Michael is.
Yeah, we're presenting, you know, your Peaceable Kingdom goal. I'll take the opportunity to thank our fabulous panel. Thank you so much.